Hi, everyone. Welcome and bienvenida to the Las Musas podcast. My name is Aisha Perez Prado, and I'm the author of Mercedes Sosa, Voice of the People. And on today's episode of Las Musas podcast, Special Topics Edition, we'll be honoring our planet and Earth Day by talking about protecting our pueblos and Pachamama. I think that's a topic that interests all of us. Today, I'm joined by a group of wonderfully environmentally conscious Musas. Chicas, can you start off by introducing yourself and giving us the title of your books?
Hi, everyone. I'm Sara Echenique, the author of Our Roof is Blue, Nuestro Techo es Azul.
Hi, I'm Adriana Hernandez-Bergstrom, the author of Abuelita and I Make Flan, Tumble, and Countdown for Nochebuena.
Hi, I'm Natalia Sylvester. I'm the author of Running, Breathe, and Come Back from 10, and the upcoming children's book, A Maneta Full of Treasures.
Hi, everyone. My name is Maria Jose Fitzgerald, and I am the author of Turtles of the Midnight Moon.
Hello, everyone. I'm Tatiana Gardel, and I'm the illustrator of The First Day of Peace and Abuelo de Sea and Me.
Hola a todos. Me llamo Lulu del Agre. I'm Lulu del Agre, and I'm the author illustrator of Cool Green, Amazing, Remarkable Trees, and Verde Fresco, Árboles Asombrosos y Extraordinarios.
Hi, everyone. My name is Gabriela Alderman, and I am the author of Paula's Patches and the upcoming Squawk of Spanish.
Hi, everyone. My name is Alyssa Reynoso Morris, and I am the author of Plátanos Are Love, The Bronx is My Home, and Gloriana Presente.
Wow, all of your books sound so interesting. I'm so excited to be joined by you. And let's start off with our first question. If you could spend a day in your story's ecosystem, which character or place would you want to explore the most? And what adventures would you embark on? Let's start with Sara.
Sure. So Our Roof is Blue tells a story of the human impact of climate change, and it follows two siblings in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. And there's this one really beautiful spread that I very badly want to visit because it's the two siblings on a beach, in a beach scene, and they're going through all of the scenarios, but in their imagination. So they're deep sea diving with their dog, and they're sunbathing on the beach with some cookies, and they're parachuting down to the sand also with their dog. The dog is ever present and he's amazing. And it just looks like a lovely day enjoying so much of the ecotourism that Puerto Rico has to offer and showing a side of the island that maybe a lot of people don't get to see very often.
That sounds amazing. I want to visit it too. How about you, Natalia?
So in Running, Maddie's father, Maddie lives in Miami and her dad is running for president. But before her life gets turned upside down by his campaign, one of the places they go just to find peace and reconnect with themselves is the Everglades. You know, I grew up in South Florida and I didn't go to the Everglades until I started writing this book. I don't know how that happened. But it's just, there's no place like it in the world. And I've always felt a really strong connection to the water. So I think the adventure I'd want to go on, like I always find myself wanting to go back to the Everglades and I've gone back since. I just love that, like, you can go so far out that all you see is water and grasslands. And there's almost like no real disconnect between what's water and what's land. It's just all as one.
That sounds so magical. That sounds amazing. Yeah, I think for me, the setting of Turtles of the Midnight Moon is La Mosquitia, which is this biosphere preserve in Honduras, where I grew up. And while I visited it growing up, I haven't been there in a really long time. And the village where I set my story is kind of this fictional combination of Tela, which is another coastal town in Honduras, where my grandmother was from, and then like Roatán, which is an island off the coast of Honduras, and then La Mosquitia. So it's this fictional place, but it's in La Mosquitia. I would want to go back there because kind of like how Natalia was describing the Everglades, like when you go there, it's like the sky is bigger than anywhere. Like the stars are so bright. Like there's very little electricity, like just vastness, like vast ocean, like just huge long stretches of beach, like no resorts, like nothing, very little man-made stuff. And so I would want to go back there and just ride a little cayuco into the marshes and like hang out with Barana and Abby on the beach, you know, and stargaze and maybe watch the turtles come ashore to lay their eggs. I think that would be amazing. Maybe take my kids with me. That would be the dream.
All of those places sound amazing. I would love to visit all of them. Let's move on to our next question. Your stories reveal the importance of taking care of the earth. If you could share one piece of eco-friendly advice from your book with young readers that they could apply in their own lives, what would it be and why? Let's start with Alyssa.
Hi, everyone. I was like the president of the environmental club when I was a kid. And so I tried to channel that into the Bronx is my home. And the number one thing that I'm always gifting everyone, and I feel like Santiago, the main character in the Bronx is my home, would give everyone, is a bamboo toothbrush, because it's something that we use every day. So I'm the person on everyone's birthday or Christmas, I'm always giving them bamboo toothbrushes. And the other thing would be like beeswax paper. So instead of like using aluminum foil, the beeswax papers is my jam. So that's my thing. What about you, Maria Jose?
So yeah, I think my eco-friendly advice would just be to monitor your plastic use, your use of plastic. I don't have like a particular product, but one thing that, I don't know, it's like a pet peeve of mine, is just this plastic world that we live in, and just the constant, like, even you go to the grocery store, you buy raspberries and they're like wrapped in plastic, or like, you know, there's like a little bit of plastic on the top of a banana, or the banana, bunches of bananas. And so just being mindful, I have this huge bucket in my kitchen that's full of all the bottle caps, like every plastic bottle cap that we collect. And yeah, just be mindful, try to limit your use of plastic.
That sounds like a good plan. How about you, Gabby?
Yeah, that sounds like a good plan. We actually have guinea pigs and they eat vegetables and fruit. But this guinea pig knows when the vegetables or fruit are coming because of the sound of plastic. And it is heartbreaking. Right. The sound of plastic, because so many things are wrapped, even like the little bit of banana. But my tidbit, my advice. So Paula's Patches celebrates mending and repairing and fixing versus buying new. So my advice would be to just stop and think before you toss. Some things could be fixed, things could be repaired, things could be taken to be repaired or serviced. If you've outgrown something, perhaps it could be a hand-me-down, or it could be taken apart to create some new, fun, creative thing. At the back of Paula's Patches, at the back of the book, I included a section on craft with fabric to get those creative juices flowing. That includes patches as well. So that would be my advice. Just stop and think before you toss. How about you, Natalia?
Yeah. Oh, I love that, Gabriela. So I think for me, my advice would be to that it's okay if you have to take, you know, if you start small. Like we don't necessarily become experts overnight on these things. And actually in running Mariana, it's really about her journey towards environmental activism. So when I was writing the book, I was really daunted by the feeling of like, oh my gosh, if she doesn't change the world by the end of this book, will it feel like it was enough? And I realized that was reflective of how I sometimes feel, like a little hopeless, a little like I can't make a difference. But the truth is that if we, you know, start small, if we start close to home and in our community, with the help of friends and family, it makes a difference. It builds ripple effects. It can inspire other people to think about all their actions, like exactly like what you all have mentioned today. And I think it also means that it'll be driven by like the love and connection that we have to our homes. So that would be my piece of advice.
Yeah, I love all that advice. It sounds amazing. That recycle, repurpose, all those things that we really want to do and have kids read about. Let's move on to the next question. Does anyone have an interesting or funny behind the scenes story about how you develop the eco-friendly elements in your book? Who should we start with? How about Sada?
Sure. So mine is not funny. okay. I don't think it's interesting. Hopefully you'll find it interesting. But I actually didn't even realize when I started writing this story. It was, of course, after Hurricane Maria, and I was really focused on what children on the island were going through, because I'd gone through hurricanes, but not like that when I lived in Puerto Rico. And so I was really focused on them. And I didn't realize until about halfway through how much it was actually about climate change and about the impact on individuals that climate change can have. And so it felt really innate to the story. I didn't try to make it more explicit in the picture book text itself, but I did make it explicit in my author's note. And I think that catches some people off guard in a good way, because a lot of people aren't used to thinking about climate change like that or about its effects. You're thinking about it as something in the future and not something that's happening present day, or actually in this case, 6 years ago now. And it's, to me, helpful to kind of drive that connection home that this is all happening, this impact to children, these events that we're going through are strongly connected to the actions and decisions people made years ago, but also that are still happening today and that we can still influence, and hopefully brings them a little more hope than sometimes I feel, at least when I'm listening to the news about climate change. What about you, Tatiana?
So the first day of peace is a story of these two communities that rely on the natural resources to produce life around them, and they depend on them. And to create the visual narrative, I was inspired by my activities at the community garden in my neighborhood that I'm part of. So I definitely tried to put a lot of that into the book. And that's not funny either, but I think it's interesting. How about you, Lulu?
Well, actually, for me, it's not really something funny, but rather something kind of like interesting and nerve-wracking, because as I was working on the illustrations of this book, which is totally nonfiction, it's about amazing and remarkable trees on the earth, I wanted to include, it's a little bit also a trip around the world, because I'm focusing on several countries in different continents. And I'm doing the research in 2020. And of course, I was extremely excited because in my list of fabulous trees, I had the baobab and the acacia, both of them a native from Africa. And we had fortunately had planned a trip to visit the countries where these trees, particularly trees, thrive. And why would you say I needed to do this? Because some people say that I'm really bizarre in thinking about illustrations. I go way beyond. And I wanted to incorporate into the illustration leaves from the real trees and bring the trees with the bark, the leaves, the flowers pressed on into the illustration, bring that a little bit of these specific trees to the reader. So 2020 happens, the trip gets canceled, obviously. And then I was lucky enough that literally I sent out emails to every single friend that I could possibly think that had relatives in Africa, Kenya, Tanzania, and eventually got to one friend who connected me to another friend who literally went during the 2020 to forage for the leaves that I needed for the pictures of the book. So that's, I don't know if it's funny, but it's quite the adventure for this book.
Wow.
How about
above
you,
and
Gabby?
Beyond, Lulu? Above and beyond for the illustrator.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's such a beautiful story of adventure and also connection. Community connection. My behind the scene tidbit, or I guess what happened was, well, the seed of the idea for Paula's Patches was my own daughter. When she was little, her pants ripped all the time. And it was those stretchy pants that if you don't catch the rip, forget sewing. It's all, it's fabric scraps. So that was happening a lot. But in general, I tend to, if something is broken, my mind goes to trying to repair or mend or to try to get it someplace to get fixed. And several times this has happened that my husband stops me and says this really rational thing, which is it worth it? And it stops me. And the sad truth is that at this stage of my life where time is so valuable and busy, and we live in a world where sometimes, because of fast fashion and whatever, sometimes it can be that fixing something could cost monetarily or financially more than buying new, like buy it again. And I wanted to, I just always kept pushing back. And I wanted to do that with Paula's Patches. I wanted to push back a little bit. And like Natalia says, we can't just fix everything. We can't just like
never throw anything and have piles because everything is valuable, but just a little bit to think and to see the value of it. And the best way I thought of sharing this message and really making, I guess, a little bit of a difference is to portray mending and repairing in a fun, creative way so that it's not just a chore, you know, especially for kids, not just a chore, but that it can be something they can be proud of and it can be something that they can be excited for. And highlight the fun of it. So that was my behind the scenes.
I love that, Gabby. And I'll throw in my own kind of funny story with City Feet, my debut author illustrator book that I did with all with collage. And, you know, I presented it to a group. It's always so fun presenting reading books to kids, you know, and then asking them questions and seeing what they answer, which is not what you expected, right? So I did the book. I had a little presentation with a bunch of kids, and then I was talking about like sustainability and cities because I'm a city girl. I love nature, but I'm really a city girl. And City Feet shows people moving through a city in a lot of different ways that are not like skipping, gliding, skateboarding, dancing, you know, all kinds of ways that don't involve pollution. So, and I talked to him about collage. I did a little collage activity. So I said, you know, so what can we learn from, you know, of City Feet, and like, what can you do in your house and in your city so that, you know, to help the earth? And they came up with, rip up your parents' books and mail, because I brought in a bunch of ripped, you know, papers that I use for collage. Take everything out of the garbage in your house. And I'm like, okay, that's not exactly like what I thought. You know, they had a lot of things, but kids are the best. I don't know. There's a lot of different ways to help, and they come up with new ones all the time.
You got like, those creative juices flowing.
Yeah, just pull stuff out of the garbage. Don't, you know, don't worry. Your mom will be fine with it.
That's exactly the message.
Okay. Let's go for another interesting, I love this possibility. If you had the opportunity to organize a nature-themed scavenger hunt based on your book, what items or clues would you include for kids to find? And what exciting discoveries do you think that they would make along the way? Adriana.
So Tumbo is in the desert, and the book itself is like a scavenger hunt. So the book itself, if you page by page, it's an actual scavenger hunt. And at the end, kids have the opportunity to go back and find all the plants and animals that were in it. And so one of the most important things that I would want to see in a nature-themed scavenger hunt is that nature is not just animals, but also plants. Because sometimes kids forget, like, nature is not just the mammals. It's also the insects. It's also, like, the fungi. It's also the plants as well. So I would definitely include a nice variety of desert creatures, saguaro cactuses, and prickly pears. And of course, I would have a tumbleweed, but maybe the tumbleweed would be the guide and like you would follow it through. I don't know. It'd be really cool. And then birds and the ladybugs, who I did not know that ladybugs congregate in Big Bend National Forest in like South Texas, North Mexico. Like I had no idea. I didn't know ladybugs were everywhere pretty much. Who else would I include? Oh yeah, snakes.
We would have so much fun.
I would definitely have so much fun. Snakes and tarantulas. Like I could, bring it all.
And as an illustrator, it's so much. It's fun also to have a scavenger hunt within your own book. You know, like I'm always hiding things in illustrations. Yes. I love doing that. And Lulu, with all your leaves, and Adriana, I'm sure you've hidden things in illustrations. So if you don't have a chance to go out in nature, you can hide nature or other things within
That is the secret with the desert ecosystem, is that at first glance, you don't see the life that's there. And then it's only until you look closely or you are observing for a longer while that you see that there is a lot of life. It's just not as green or vibrant as what we are used to if we come from tropical places.
Yes. So, yeah. Yes. I might be the only non-tropical person here.
Yeah, you might. I think you might be.
I'm the dark, the dark.
You're the darkness. And there's are yeah, there's also the beautiful ecosystems that thrive at night, you know?
Yeah.
And I do touch upon that in Tumble. And Lulu is one of my inspirations.
And even if
way.
You're not, you know, there's also, I just came back from Patagonia, which is a yeah. whole different kind of an ecosystem. And the blues that you see yes. are amazing. Sky.
Well, and if I may add something for the audience here, is that what you mentioned, Adriana, the word ecosystem, we should be aware of the whole ecosystem and how animals, all sorts of animals in, you know, in every strata of animals interact with the plants in order to make the ecosystem live, and yes. how we as humans can what we can do to preserve the ecosystems.
Yes, and to every little bit, it's all interconnected. That's why they changed it. When we were yeah. kids, it was always called the food chain, but now they call it a web, because we realize mm-hmm. that everything that we touch, if we touch anything, like the strands of it have bigger repercussions than we thought. It's not just a straight line. But yeah, that's
absolutely.
What I was
doing. Alyssa, yeah, and that's sticking with the theme of illustration, because we're having a lot of illustration related stuff, which is great, because these are picture books, right? Illustrations tell half of the story, sometimes more. So let's talk about the illustrations and how they play a crucial role in bringing your stories to life. Do any of you have a favorite illustration that captures the essence of your story? Can we start with you, Lulu?
Well, actually, I do. It's not really my favorite. It is the kids' favorite. Every time that I talk about, you know, I read the book, Cool Green, to kid audiences, I will ask, which is your favorite tree? And they all mostly always respond, the rainbow gum. And that is because the rainbow gum, scientific name, the Eucalyptus deglupta, and I do mention the scientific name because it's the only way that you can find more about a species is literally by researching the scientific name. There's tons of common names for every single tree that you know, or every single animal species. You need a scientific name. And in the back of my book, you have all the scientific names of every single tree and cool facts about them. But the thing is that, going back to the rainbow gum, why the rainbow gum? I literally show the picture of the illustration that I made, and that has literally all the colors of the rainbow on the bark of the tree. And I'll ask the trees, the kids, do you think that this tree exists? They'll go, no. Then I show the photo of this tree after it has rained in Indonesia, where it's native from, and they go, wow, because it truly is an amazing tree with the bark as it peels it, every single color of the rainbow as it peels and ages appears. So it's a never-ending masterpiece, the bark of the rainbow gum. So that That's is beautiful. The answer.
So for my book, The Bronx is My Home, the illustrations did play a huge role. I'm not the illustrator, so I always enjoy being paired with amazing illustrators to see them bring my words to life. And I think one of the most crucial is actually at the very beginning, and it's a map of the Bronx. And Kim just did an amazing job showcasing the Bronx and all of the gems. And it really, my question, it kind of also hits on question number four about the scavenger hunt, because The Bronx is My Home is basically like a big scavenger hunt of a book. They go to Pelham Bay Park, and I show a lot of facts in there of it's actually the biggest park in New York City. And everyone laughs whenever I read that line, because they're like, what are you trying to say? And I was like, I'm not trying to throw shade to Central Park, but just so you know, the biggest park in New York City happens to be in the Bronx. Yes. And there's a lot of that throughout the book. And I'm just so glad that Kim Holt was able to really encapsulate that. One of the first spreads that you see is beekeepers getting bees from the rooftop. And so I loved incorporating nature, even though when you think of the Bronx, you think of an urban setting, you think of concrete jungle, you don't think of nature. And then also one of the other major ones that I was crying about is when they're at the Bronx Zoo, the way that Kim just illustrated the Bronx Zoo. It's just, she nailed it. She killed it. And then again, like, threw in the fun fact in there that the Bronx Zoo is the largest metropolitan zoo in the country, because I feel like the Bronx gets a lot of, like, it doesn't get the recognition that it deserves as a place where amazing, where you can find amazing things. Yeah.
Wow, you just taught me something. I didn't know that about the Bronx. I assumed Central Park was the biggest park, or and the zoo. Wow.
So yeah, Central Park has a dicey history, which I won't get into in this podcast. But
no need to get into the dicey history.
Unlike Pelham Bay Park, you didn't have to displace anyone in order to create it. So a little bit more shade to Central Park. But what about you, Natalia?
Yeah, so funny enough, running is YA, so there are no illustrations, right? But on the cover, my favorite part is that Maddie is holding a protest sign that has water waves and the word now on it. And I think it speaks so simply to the urgency of, you know, of environmental, you know, of climate change, of how we can make a difference. But it also gives me a lot of hope, because it means that we can all be doing something now, and that it's not too late. And that, you know, we can also always now be making a difference in our local environments and beyond.
So true. And wow, you guys are making me think a lot about my environment and what I can do, which, yeah, clearly I can do more. But I wanted to ask you too about something interesting, like a fun fact or an interesting tidbit that you learned about the natural world, maybe about being environmentally conscious or something else, during your research for your book.
So the way that I ended up writing about tumbleweeds is because of it's like a weird circumstance. It was when I lived in New Mexico for a bit, and so I was inspired to write it because my son brought it up, and I was like, oh, tumbleweed. But when I first got to New Mexico, I had no idea that tumbleweeds were real. And so the first time I saw one in real life, I was like, oh, they're not squiggles in a cartoon, Snoopy cartoon specifically, or Roadrunner. They are real. And so I had to like completely refigure my brain and realize, oh my gosh, they're actually plants. So one, tumbleweeds are real. They're actually plants, and they're actually on purpose. They break off to spread their seeds. And so for me, the entire concept of tumbleweeds was, it was like I was a child, you know, learning for the first time that these things exist. It's like learning about dinosaurs for the first time. They are a huge variety of species underneath one umbrella term. So the term tumbleweeds talks about hundreds of different kinds of plants. So we're talking about Russian thistle, which is very invasive, which is the one we see the most, and it's very ubiquitous. It's the idea of what we have of a tumbleweed is usually Russian thistle. And it's not even native to the United States. It came, there's like all these theories of how it got here, but either way, most of them are about like they came by mistake on various trade ships. There are actual native species of tumbleweed. They're way smaller. They are native to parts of the Chihuahuan Desert, and they are actually ferns, and they rehydrate. So for me, I completely nerded out. I actually visited the Living Desert Museum. I since I was already going to West Texas anyway, that's where my in-laws live, and I went, and then we went to New Mexico, and we went to other parts, and we just looked at real tumbleweeds. And they can be huge. They can be as big as, like, I don't know, let's see, probably up to my shoulder. I'm only 5 feet tall, so probably about 4 feet tall. And they can gather up, if there's crazy windstorms, they can actually block entire buildings. So imagine this invasive species, like, blocking highways and like homes and stuff. A recent windstorm in Utah and Nevada, you can look this up, actually blocked homes. So you can look it up, just Wikipedia or Google, whatever you choose to look it up. Tumbleweeds block highway, or tumbleweeds enclose homes. And you will find some of the most just whoa images of tumbleweed causing crazy mayhem. Anyway, so those are some of the amazing things that I've learned about while I was writing my book and illustrating it. And yeah, wonders never cease with nature with me. I'm like a curious child.
Yeah, that Adriana, that's so cool. I had no idea that tumbleweeds could do that. I'm a little bit blown away. I'm definitely going to Google it as soon as we stop recording.
Was that a pun intended? Did you say blown away on purpose?
No. Tumbleweed? Oh my God. No, I did not. That was good. I learned so many tidbits about the natural world when I was doing research for Turtles of the Midnight Moon. I knew a lot about leatherback sea turtles already just because I have an obsession with sea turtles. So, I mean, I one of the things, though, that I did have to research was how long they could hold their breath. And I think it was something like 80 to 90 minutes or something like that. They could hold their breath. I mean, they travel thousands of miles, right? Leatherback sea turtles are the biggest of the sea turtle species. And, you know, they don't have a carapace. They have a soft carapace, like bony plates on top. They're smooth. They're just so majestic. I did learn that like the biggest one ever recorded was 10 feet long, which I think is crazy. I mean, it's like dinosaur size, like huge.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, leatherbacks are amazing. Like, you know, they're really fascinating reptiles. One thing I learned that I didn't know that was, it's sort of unrelated to sea turtles, but it had to do with some of the connections I was making with the fishing industry and the fisheries, the lobster diving industry back home. So something interesting I learned about the lobster diving industry that I didn't know was that the females, like when the free divers go down to, you know, get their catch, like if they catch the females, they have to put them back in the water. So, and they can only take the male lobsters with them. And the females, the way you tell is like, you look under their like abdomen and the females have like pairs of swimmerettes on each like appendage. And they're like more feathery and the males only have one pair per like segment. And then obviously sometimes you can see the eggs like on the exoskeleton of the females. And that was something pretty cool that like, I didn't know much about the lobster diving industry and what happens to the divers and, you know, the problem with the bends and all these things that happen. So that was really cool to learn and find out how it's, and it's all kind of connected, like the issues with egg poaching, like sea turtle egg poaching. I mean, a lot of it is just people trying to make a living, you know, and it's connected to the fishing industry and so many other things that I just think it's all really fascinating. Unlike you, Adriana, I can go down a rabbit hole of all this stuff and like Natalia said too, like get overwhelmed. And then I'm like, okay, just, you know, we can take it one step at a time.
No, I just wanted to add what I discovered in my search for the most amazing, remarkable trees on earth. My favorite ended up being the one that is the most humble because it's truly the most nutritious. And I didn't know about this tree, and it grows in many tropical countries. It is the Moringa, Moringa oleifera, and it's so nutritious that it's like I said, a very humble tree, so nutritious that you can eat the bark, the pods, the seeds, the leaves as salad. Literally, I do grow a Moringa in my house and we eat the leaves as salad. The powder leaves have as much protein as powder milk. So it's used in countries that do not have the wealth that we have to help with malnutrition. Moringa grows in Puerto Rico, for example. And
Florida too.
Yeah, in Florida too. And actually so popular that it has 160 common names. But many people do not know about the power of this tree. Even in medicinal powers, it is being studied right now because it seems that it does cure cancer. It is still under study, but there is a great research about that. So there's so many amazing facts about this very humble tree. It doesn't look like much, but it's a powerhouse. And that's something that I wanted to leave kids or the audience with, is that if you want to plant a seed from a tree, choose Moringa. You even in Washington, D.C., I have a Moringa tree living inside during the winter, outside during the summer, and we eat its leaves. Tatiana?
Amazing, Lulu. Thank you. So when I received the manuscript to illustrate the first day of peace, I was fascinated by the description of the environment, which are very different from where I come from, Brazil. And one thing that I didn't know, and actually I'd never seen, was like rice terraces. So in the book, the mountain people, they plant rices and they have these rice terraces. So visually to me, because I'm an illustrator, that was like amazing and really hard to make sense of it and to merge all the information that I was receiving from the text, because I've never seen it, of course. And the research was extensive. Yeah, so this is something that I learned that I didn't know. And it was very nice.
Yeah, those rice terraces are really beautiful if you get a chance to see them in person. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to mention that I have a book coming out about Mercedes Sosa. I don't know if you guys are fans or you've heard her music, but she was a singer and social activist from Argentina. And one of her more well-known songs, not her most well-known, but one is called Todo Cambia, right? And I just want to read a little bit of the lyrics of that because I think it applies to what we're talking about today. And it's in Spanish. Cambia lo superficial, cambia también lo profundo. Cambia el modo de pensar, cambia todo en este mundo. Cambia el clima, con los años, cambia el pastor, su rebaño. Y así como todo cambia, que yo cambie, no es extraño. And I love that because for those whose Spanish is a little rusty, it's talking about everything changes, including the climate, and we can also change, right? So we can change our response maybe to the climate. And I think it's so lovely that we have all these Latine creators who are out there making stories for kids who are the ones who are going to change, right? Before we do or help us change along the way. I know that my kids certainly tell me what to do every day. Okay, guys, chicas, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciated listening to you all, and thank you for joining the Las Musas podcast. If you'd like to learn more about Las Musas or our books, please visit our website at lasmusasbooks.com or find us on social media at Las Musas Books. And be sure to check out our bookshop page, where each purchase of one of our books goes towards supporting independent bookstores. If you enjoyed this episode, please like, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also sign up for the Las Musas newsletter to have podcast updates as well as other Musa news, such as release dates, teasers, spotlights, and more delivered straight to your inbox. Gracias, gracias a todas, and thanks for listening. Ciao.